Welcome to the Wealth Inequality Initiative podcast, shedding light on wealth inequality with experts from around the world. Today, Laura Henrica, CEO of the Julius Baer Foundation, meets Ariane Delanoy, the Associate Professor and Chief Researcher at the University of Cape Town, reflects on today's state of wealth inequality, its levers, and how we can mitigate it for a more stable and sound society.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Laura Henrica. I am the CEO of the Julius Baer Foundation, and I'm delighted to have with me today Ariane Delanoy, who joins us from Cape Town in South Africa, to talk about wealth inequality and why it is so important to address this issue. Ariane Delanoy is an associate professor and chief researcher at the Southern Africa Labor and Development Research Unit at the University of Cape Town. She completed her PhD in sociology at the University of Cape Town in 2008, and meanwhile has over 20 years of research experience. She has deep expertise in developing mixed method studies and leading multi-stakeholder projects. In her work, she is consistently focused on youth and youth development in the complex context of post-apartheid South Africa, which is characterized by poverty and inequality. Since 2018, she's been advising us at the Julius Baer Foundation on wealth inequality projects, first as an external and now since 2020 as a foundation board member. Ariane, thank you so much for being here with me today. It's wonderful to have this discussion with you and to share with our listeners why the topic of wealth inequality is so pressing.
Thank you so much for having me here, Laura. It is always wonderful to see conversation spaces like this open up. So thank you.
So to kick us off, Ariane, help me set the scene a little bit. According to your studies, what is the state of wealth inequality in the world today in 2024? And, you know, what, for people like yourself who are in the academic space, what are the main aspects of wealth inequality that you're concentrating on at the moment?
Sure. So according to the latest reports, we're still looking at a situation where the world's richest 1% hold more than twice as much wealth as about 7 billion people combined. So we're looking at some highly unequal distribution of resources, with the top 1% owning about 45% or more of global wealth and the bottom 50% owning just about 1%. And of course, when looking at those total numbers, there's a number of dimensions that are hidden. We know that women are always disproportionately affected by wealth inequality. There are a range of racial dynamics and, of course, geographical differences. We know the African countries, several of the global South countries, are more heavily affected by inequality than others. Your question was, what are we concentrating on at the moment?
Yeah, with such incredible numbers, what are the academics focused on?
Well, it's such a big problem that there is so much to focus on, right? So that it's very much a language, you know, and a multidisciplinary approach that we're seeing within academia. People working in different domains, from economics to sociology to public policy, trying to understand what the drivers are and what the causes are, and the consequences. So what's the lock-on effect of these kinds of large numbers for the individual, for their families, for society? But also, how do we best measure this? How do we really understand what we're talking about? What kind of data do we need? How do we analyze the data accurately? And how do we approach it consistently across these different regions? Because otherwise, what are we trying to compare? There's a lot of thinking also around the policy and the implementation responses that could potentially shift the situation and why that is or isn't happening. And there's also been so much happening in the world over the past decade that's keeping everybody on their toes. We're looking at, we looked at a global pandemic that kind of shut down the world as we knew it, which also then deepened levels of poverty and inequality. We're looking at large migration streams, environmental changes. So there's a lot of questions that kind of keep coming to us that we're trying to stay on top of.
Yeah. Yeah, and that complexity and that vast expanse, actually, of wealth inequality is something that we're going to touch on a little bit later in this conversation again. But if we look at your experience, especially being based in South Africa, and more precisely in Cape Town, at the University of Cape Town. South Africa being, I think, on the Gini coefficient index, is the most unequal country in the world. What does it mean to do research on inequality precisely within that environment, the most unequal of surroundings?
It's quite a daily visceral experience, right? So my work starts with quantitative and qualitative data. Qualitative data means the collection of it means that I venture into all kinds of areas. And I want to try and understand what the lived experiences are of people in different areas of South Africa and Cape Town, the city. And so I really live a constant confrontation with the absolute extremes, right? From the wealthiest, best resourced areas of the city to the poorest, most desperate areas. And so it literally moving in and out. It literally means moving in and out of entirely different worlds and speaking to people, young people in particular, about entirely different experiences of life, chances in life, and also realizing on a daily basis really how unsustainable the situation is, how deeply unhappy it makes so many in the country, not only those socioeconomically excluded.
Yeah. Now, for perhaps compared to other academics, you really have the real life situation so much more visible to you every day as you progress through your work. You mentioned actually just now, not only talking with young people who are more socially or economically disadvantaged, but that it's also something that should be of concern to rather those who are on the other side of that extreme. And could you elaborate a little bit more on that? Like, why is it important? Why should we be concerned about wealth inequality? Why is this topic, there are many other topics out there that are getting a lot of attention right now. Climate is one that we hear a lot about, of course, every day, rightfully so. But what about wealth inequality? Does it get the attention it merits?
I think, as you say, it is difficult, I think, to build the case for more attention to wealth inequality when it feels like there are many other challenges that almost feel more urgent because they play out immediately. And like I said earlier, the refugee and migration streams, war, all these things that seem to be turning our world into turmoil. But when we look at wealth inequality, and it's connected to all of these aspects, of course. When wealth and resources and assets and the possibility to build up a life for oneself are so concentrated among a small proportion of the population and leave such large numbers of people excluded, it affects everything from a sense of social cohesion and trust in a society. You can understand how a small proportion or a large proportion of the population being excluded leads to a sense of resentment. I often hear young people talk about how they feel entirely invisible in a society that doesn't seem structured to enable them to move forward. And so that lack of social cohesion and distrust affects everybody, also those who have. It also affects, or wealth inequality also really affects the possibility for economic growth, right? When we look at wealth being concentrated among just a few individuals or groups, it means there's opportunities limited for others to fully take part in the labor market and in the economy. And so we see a reduction of consumer demand, a reduction of possibilities to grow and produce. And what we see definitely coming out of the research as well is that these high levels or countries that face higher levels of wealth inequality also face worse levels of health and well-being, emotional well-being and physical well-being across society. So it doesn't only affect those who can't access high-quality private healthcare, but it also affects those who can, because we're looking at increased levels of violence, mm-hmm. increased levels of stress and insecurity and instability. So really, there is a case to be made for everybody to be more concerned with wealth inequality.
And you started touching on just how many aspects there are to wealth inequality in what you were saying just now. But can you tell us more about, can you actually talk about what causes of inequalities there are that ultimately hinder a society's economic growth and prosperity? Is that possible to nail down? Or
I can try, and there I will almost certainly overlook.
Knowing that we have only a podcast to answer that question.
So there are very many, right? Would be the first answer. And many of them are interrelated and also kind of feed upon one another, which is why it is such a complex conversation to be had. But we know that I did touch upon that just now, when there is a limited possibility for the development of human capital, when there are limited possibilities to access high quality education and build up skills and lower access to quality healthcare, then we're looking at a potential workforce that isn't as strong as it could be and as well equipped as it could be, which then in turn hampers productivity and innovation. So we're looking at a cycle of exclusion and a downward development cycle, if you look at it from that perspective. Then, of course, you know, an additional driver that kind of keeps the problem feeding upon itself is the fact that resources are unequally distributed, right? So when we talk about wealth inequality, I think it's important to remember we're not only talking income inequality, we're really talking wealth, which consists also of assets, of the ability to have a savings account, to invest in money, and to build more than income only. And when that is mostly concentrated in a smaller proportion of the population, it means we're looking at a larger proportion that can consume less. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but so the consumption.
No, yeah, absolutely.
The possibility to consume and to invest among the majority of the population is limited, and that in turn feeds things as difficulties with starting up businesses, with getting entrepreneurship going. Because people who don't have access to assets and at least a basic pot of savings will find it very difficult to access other financial means to start up a business, for instance. So there's many different drivers that kind of keep one another going. And the one I touched upon in the previous question as well is that aspect of how high levels of inequality really also lead to social unrest and potential instability, which makes it difficult for investors to trust in an environment that could potentially then see businesses grow. It's a fraction.
Yeah, and really talking about it's a real vicious cycle where each element keeps that cycle going in a downward spiral. And indeed, we see that sense of where an individual situation impacts a household, a community, and then eventually also GDP and broader economic or social context. So shifting to the solutions, because that sounds pretty overwhelming, shifting to the solutions, when has research been able to distinguish certain factors that would mitigate wealth inequality? What's truly helpful in your experience in addressing the problem?
So yes, research has been able to point out a number of potential mitigation strategies. There isn't necessarily a unified opinion about what to focus on first and how, but that is, I think, the nature of research and the fact that this keeps evolving. Yes. Some of the factors that come back in most of the research is thinking around the implementation of redistributed policies. And that, of course, again, in South Africa, it's quite important, or in the context of South Africa, it's quite important to think about that, right? When structural forces have meant that poverty and inequality were really structurally entrenched in a society, then how do you begin to think about undoing that? And some argue mm-hmm. that the biggest and most urgent factor to focus on is access to quality education, so that people can build up skills and knowledge and gain opportunities to create pathways out of poverty and into higher income earnings. But others will argue that that in itself overlooks a number of other aspects that contribute to wealth inequality, such as the access to decent housing and decent healthcare. So when we think about redistributive policies, we're talking about a number of social welfare programs that can include anything from cash transfers to making public education available. And then the sidebar would then be that it has to be quality public education.
Yes. Not just any kind of education.
I mean, the nuances matter in this story, right? And then there are other aspects, yes, such as, you know, can we think about increasing access to financial services, for instance, for low-income individuals, so that mm-hmm. it makes it easier for them to access credit, but they can also then access saving tools, investments, and begin to build assets so that they're also protected, yes, to new poverty shocks when they come along throughout the mm-hmm. global pandemic again. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned education. I think there's a couple of examples in the world where countries have doubled down on education, and that seems to have had a positive impact. Are there examples of overcoming wealth inequality at a country level or community, city level that you would highlight?
So I don't think there is a country that has completely eliminated wealth inequality, but there are examples of areas in the world where progress has been made in reducing inequality and in keeping inequality down. The Scandinavian countries are often the ones that are mentioned, because extensive social security programs that have included free access to high-quality education and healthcare have played quite an important role there, alongside of other policies. So there is then the mm-hmm. thinking around active employment policies that can prioritize job creation and can ensure access to decent jobs, because that's another one of those nuances. And so the Scandinavian countries kind of consistently rank better in terms of social mobility and equal opportunities in many other parts of the world. And I think from the Global South, one of the examples that comes up is Argentina, for instance, where there has definitely been an increased focus on reducing both poverty and inequality with the implementation of social protection programs. Again, expanding access to quality education and healthcare. But also looking at things as increasing pensions and implementing progressive taxation reforms, for example.
And it's so interesting to hear that it's really a combination of factors between, yes, policies, but other programs as well as investments in social security. If we get really now focused on the Judith Speier Foundation and the work that we're doing together, we're focused on a slightly different area, which is supporting solutions that are win-wins, where we're bringing together those who are in a situation of privilege with those who are more disadvantaged, and where dialogue and exchange between those groups are at the center of the work that we do, and in trying to create sustainable solutions that include these two parts of the dynamic. What do you see as the advantages of that approach? And is it a fail-safe solution, or are there also risks in that approach?
Well, I think it's a very courageous approach, right? And I think it speaks to the fact that one of the consequences of these high levels of inequality that I mentioned earlier is this breakdown of a social of social trust, of social cohesion, but it also recognizes mm-hmm. yeah. the fact that knowledge and resources live in different ways at both ends of the spectrum. So I think what is an absolute positive mm-hmm. about it is this attempt to begin to build a fabric and a dialogue with those who have who are excluded or at the very bottom of the income distribution and the wealth distribution, have a voice. And so this sense of isolation and invisibility can be broken by providing a platform for conversation. And we, those who live in that top part of society, get an opportunity to begin to share knowledge and resources and understand the lived reality of those who are not in that top layer. There is a risk in that there is always, in conversations like that, a power dynamic. And I think I touched on it earlier as well. Power is also often one of the drivers that keep, or the distortion of power is often a driver that keeps inequality going. And so it requires careful thinking around how this is facilitated and how experiences from both sides are heard and shared, and how, I suppose, the potential for power dynamics to sneak in is mitigated.
Yeah, and philanthropy is sometimes a topic where that power dynamic is brought to the surface again. There's a lot of dialogue now in the philanthropy space around how do you make sure that power dynamic is a positive, is not impacting the relationship and the work in a negative way. And maybe that's not entirely unrelated to academia. You know, in all of this, how do academic work and philanthropic work in this space play together? You know, what is the role of academia versus the one of philanthropy? Do they play well together?
Well, I think they could. And I think, I think a lot of it relies on a solid commitment to wanting to make a difference, right? And to not use either research or philanthropy as a almost window dressing approach, but there, if it is underbuilt with a solid commitment to wanting to build a more just society, then I think there's great potential, because you know there's a lot to be learned from academic work that has had to grapple with where the evidence sits and how to understand different kinds of evidence as well. It goes back to that multidisciplinarity. It's that bigger question that it is useful to look across what anthropology is teaching us and what the economists are teaching us. So you have both the realities and the big data sets that show us the trends. And for that knowledge to feed into how philanthropy is approaching the question and the interventions, I think there's an absolute strength in building an evidence base and in sharing an evidence base collaboratively. And the other way around, philanthropy has the possibility to find research that could contribute to that knowledge base. And then I think a snowball effect of that, of sticking together of the heads and the pieces of knowledge, is that you can then begin to think about what kind of policy and advocacy approach is possible, if any. I think if the strengths of both worlds are combined with a critical lens, there's great.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, and I often talk about, especially, you know, we as a foundation that's associated with a bank, about using the right kinds of capital for the right kinds of impact. And philanthropic capital has the benefit of being patient capital that can be used to support things that may not require an immediate tangible outcome, academic research being one of those, which can then lead to that outcome.
No, I think that's a crucial point you just made, because very often within the research environment, and even I think the implementation environment, we see this kind of shorter term drive on the funding side, right? Because the need is so high, we need to find solutions now. But if there was an easy solution to be found, we would have by now gotten these. So this, the ability
hopefully done it. Yes.
The ability to allow space from the side of the philanthropy, I think, is and time is really crucial, because it and that in itself requires some trust, right? That the funds will be used to do that, and a commitment then from the other side, to do it properly and to get it right.
Yeah. And that, you know, brings us back to your position, actually, as an academic on the board of a philanthropic foundation like the Julius Baer Foundation. So you've been an advisor, you've been our board member and an advisor to the Wealth Inequality Initiative and the topics related to wealth inequality for the past 5 years now. And throughout this collaboration, what has been the most significant takeaway for you?
I think the courage of a Swiss bank foundation to say, let's look at this question and let's see how we can tackle this. But then, of course, also again, the complexity, because there are so many different drivers. So what to focus on? What are the projects we think that could be the biggest return on investing in a particular project? And how do we draw lessons from the different projects that we support, so that we again feed into that bigger knowledge base that we can then ultimately keep going? So I think the innovation and the courageousness of the approach is the recognition among the foundation that true change will involve the building of a large set of data through projects that can show us what is and isn't working. What can we learn in many different contexts about, you know, where the levers are to make a difference, and what is that difference then exactly, and how is it sustained? So the more we kind of chip away at the question, the more questions come up, right? Because how do we measure change, and how do we define change over what spectrum of time? So I've really appreciated actually the work of the foundation to try and begin to get a handle on this bigger question.
And it's a constant journey, I think, as you've seen also over the last few years, of the learning that we need to do about the topic of wealth inequality, which is constant and ongoing, and the learnings we want to extract from our work, and then also in our approach, right, of trying to always keep evolving in how we do the work that we do. Maybe to wrap up, if you look forward, what would you like to see happening in the next 4 or 5 years? In the space and with the Julius Baer Foundation?
In the space, a big space, it would be really great to to see a real growing awareness of the unsustainability of the current status quo, right? A true commitment to fighting these levels of inequality and the social injustice that is created by it. And I suppose an understanding of how this level of socioeconomic exclusion really, really does disempower people and takes away their dignity. You know, there's a saying in Africa, South Africa, that people that we need to draw on our Ubuntu, the sense of our collective humanity. You know, I am what I am because of who we all are. And so I think that commitment and that respect for social and human dignity and justice is why that would be great to see more stakeholders truly engage with and truly begin to think around collaboratively. And I think the foundation has a unique place in looking at how it can convene dialogues and spaces around this. And there's some careful thinking, I think, that can be done around who to bring into those conversations. Who are the stakeholders who need to be there, and who can really begin to drive an agenda going forward? And a consideration for how the wealth inequality really does intersect with all these other dynamics that we're seeing playing out at a global scale at the moment.
And I think that's such a crucial part of the topic of wealth inequality, and yet at the same time makes it such a large problem to address, right? And it can feel maybe a bit overwhelming, but if we all contribute in some way, whether as a foundation, as individuals, we can make a change, maybe very much related to what you were saying about Ubuntu. What would you recommend to our listeners, wealthy or not? What actions could they take, however small, in everyday life, to work towards closing the divide?
I think stopping for a moment to consider their own position in society and ask what the resources, and then I mean this very broadly, that they have that could potentially be shared to try and make a difference, whether that is sharing a piece of information or knowledge on how to access or how to apply for higher education, you know, for those who might find it difficult to understand and find the information for where that's possible. Looking at the scholarship programs exist that could be contributed to so that more young people have an opportunity to access quality education. Thinking about how to support local businesses and local workers, and whether mm-hmm. that support involves things as fair wages and decent living conditions working conditions, volunteering with organizations that are trying to make a difference to at least uplift and mitigate the worst levels of poverty, and I think just being mindful and informed around wealth inequality and what drives it, and therefore perhaps also becoming a little bit more mindful in one's own consumption.
Thank you, Ariane. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Wealth Inequality Initiative podcast. How did you find this episode? Please go to www.wealth-inequality.net to share your thoughts and comments and for more insights into the topic of wealth inequality.